Hi, I'm Scott.
I'm Pete. We're from Dry the River.
But if someone were just to go, I'm listening to Weights and Measures, right? And they never saw you, if they never really went any deeper, there's a whole lot of stuff that couldn't possibly be in the bio.
Well, we can actually do the opposite because our bio is a complete pack of lies. So we'll tell you the truth and maybe it'll be some sort of expose. I think, for example, a lot of people seem to think I'm Norwegian. I was born in Norway, but I'm not Norwegian. Somehow that made it into the biog.
Constantly
I think
getting asked
they were desperately trying to make us a more exciting kind of band.
I was going to ask, what's the famous Norwegian dish? I was going to ask you, since we were going to cook stuff in the fireplace. No,
there's a dish called gravidlaks, which is like a raw fish with like a lot of stuff. Yeah, they have it all over Scandinavia.
Yeah,
I spoke mostly seafood, you know, for obvious reasons.
Right. But back to the reality.
See,
there we go. We're off kilter already.
we're actually all it's a kind of a generic story. We're from a bunch of hardcore bands and punk bands in the UK, and we just all knew each other from this little insular scene that was going on, and we made a band.
Ended up just working on this. Pete wrote some acoustic songs, gave us all a phone call, and we just started playing them. We made up a bio saying that Pete was Norwegian and Johnny used to be homeless and people bought it.
And the rest is history. We're done. Thank you.
I spent a lot of time shouting at the guys initially saying stop, because I'd written these folk songs and we'd always been in like rock and hardcore bands. So I spent a lot of time saying stop playing these like a hardcore band. This is too...
Stop rocking out.
You guys are constantly playing everything too loud and heavy and we need to simplify everything and strip it back. And in the end, I couldn't hold it back any longer and we just became like a rock band playing folk songs, so that's kind of where we're at now, like halfway.
So that's a frock band, wouldn't it be? A folk rock band, a frock band.
Yeah, frock.
Yeah, so that means in the British term, you have to be wearing amazingly glitzy outfits as a frock band, right?
Yeah, dress.
See, I've given you your new genre. You're a frock band.
That's cool.
I was told the other day that we're our live show. Someone said we're halfway between Spinal Tap and A Mighty Wind, which I thought was pretty great.
Of what I've heard so far, this is gorgeous. You know, but what I mean gorgeous is that I think that already people are trying to put genres and sounds around this band. Then you see the live show, and you already alluded to this. It's kind of like, they're going to be the next Mumford. But so is everybody, right? Every single band that writes a pretty song now has to be a member of Communion. And I think that's a bunch of nonsense. So there really is, if people really take their time to dig in, they're gonna find out that there's a lot more than the fact that Weights and Measures is, you know, probably going to blow up and be a huge hit here.
Oh, I hope so. That's cool. Yeah. I mean, we're just... And getting comparisons to Mumford and stuff like that happens. You know, we have three-part harmonies, and so did bands 30, 40 years ago, you know, that we maybe sound more similar to some of them.
We were kind of surprised when we did start. People did start saying this is a new kind of folk band from East London. They're
like,
part of
what?
That whole
folk
scene with Noah and the Whale and people, because we thought, we didn't realise that we were.
I thought we were a rock band, but we just realised that all three of us could kind of sing and it sounded cool, so
we just
started
doing
it.
but wanted to. I think, you know, but actually, I think for us in the US, you guys seem a little bit less preoccupied with the whole genre thing.
Lumping everyone
in the UK, they have this constant thing about authenticity, and you know, we read some reviews saying this is a beautiful record, but if they were from like the Appalachian Mountains or whatever, but because they're from London, it's not an authentic record.
It's all fake.
And I think, you know, especially in like the world how it is now, there is no like geographically located music. You know, kids from anywhere in the world can listen to music from anywhere else in the world. If you like it, I think it must be a sad thing to be a listener to music where you're like, I like this record, but I can't bring myself to appreciate it because I know that it's not from this region. That's like ridiculous. That's the funny thing as well. I think part of it is the UK is just a small place. Physically, geographically, such a small place. The US, you know, it's so huge and so diverse, and like the cultural variation and the, you know, it's just so much bigger that people just aren't as concerned with, you know, where something is from.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you just, you know, whereas in the UK they really are, just because we don't have that so much. It's so small and so kind of...
This record already in the UK has done pretty darn ridiculously well, right? But what does it take? It takes 300,000 copies or something like that to get a gold in the UK?
Yeah, we haven't done that yet.
But it has done really, really well, despite the fact that everybody's trying to put the label on.
You know, people are going to try and like lump you in with different bands and stuff. But yeah, critically, like since it's been out, it's had some such cool reviews and stuff. We're really like stoked about how well received it's been, and it's, you know, it kind of got into the top, you know, the album charts and stuff, which we're really excited about. You know, we're still just like this tiny band. We feel really new and like green, and all of a sudden to be, you know, in a list of artists that some of
you,
some
we went in above Meatloaf in the album chart, and that was
okay. Now, if you're above Meatloaf, yeah, I believe me, I still play him scarily enough.
I still listen to Bad Out of Hell every now and again.
It's an amazing record.
Great record.
Jim Steinman's just, insane.
Yeah.
My grandfather wanted to buy me a record for Christmas one year and said, "What do you want?" And I made him go and buy me Bat Out of Hell. He said he going into a record.
I could just see your grandfather doing that. He's going into the HMV and going, "I'd like Bat Out of Hell."
That's it. And then he said, with the artwork on the front as well, is kind of, I don't know,
yes,
it's pretty.
Right.
And he was kind of like looking at, like, "I don't think I can actually buy this record."
It's kind of like my great. And then he goes to your mom and says, "Listen, we need to talk about your son. He's got some issues. He's got some demonic issues here, and I think you better keep an eye on the razor blades."
I think Meatloaf is probably essential for a good sort of balanced childhood.
Any teenager growing up.
I'm going to raise my kids on Meatloaf for sure.
There's a good quote here, and I know it's one of you. Folky gospel music played by a post-punk band.
Yeah, sounds about it.
So let's elaborate on that.
It just really naturally came into place. We just sort of played songs that we liked, and we never really thought. In fact, when we started this band, it was really like, you know, we'd been playing in bands for such a long time, and, you know, working our day jobs at the same time, and dreaming of being able to do it full time and stuff like that. And we kind of decided, we sort of gave up on that dream, and I was happy to continue my career. I was doing like web development for like 5 years after college, and I was happy to sort of continue doing that and just doing bands in our spare time.
I was at medical school, so I did like social anthropology, really. So if anything, it's sitting around talking about stuff, which is one of the few things I've managed to do. What I was alarmed at when I got to medical school was, in anthropology, even if you didn't really know anything about what you were talking about, if you just spoke about it eloquently, you'd do kind of okay. In medicine, I tried that approach of not really knowing and just
kill people.
Well, yeah. Aside from that, the lecturers went, "You clearly have absolutely no idea what you're talking about." So it didn't go so well. I think I had a lucky escape from medical school, or the medical profession had a lucky escape from me.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, this band started, you know, people started coming to these shows and being really excited about it, and someone offered us the opportunity to do it full time. It's like, okay, now this is happening. All these songs are going to start ending up on radio and stuff. It's just kind of blew our mind. It still blows my mind now. You know, we're like, 2 years into full time, and it's every day I just wake up, I'm like, thank God I get to do this. It's my job. It's just so awesome.
So where's the segue from Transgressive to Dry the River?
Transgressive.
They sort of, those guys came to some shows London, didn't they?
It was the weirdest thing, because we were fully in this point where we were almost resigned to, like, we'd always just done bands because
we loved it
and loved playing live and stuff, and we'd, you know, spent every penny that we had on being musicians and stuff, and we got to the point where we were like, okay, you know, we've been doing this for 10 years now since we were kids, and let's just chill out and do, you know, let's not
focus on our jobs.
Yeah, not push it so hard anymore. And then Transgressive came out of nowhere one day, said we love the music and we want to try and do this, and we sat down in one meeting with them, and they said, right, we have a record label, we have a publishing arm, we have whatever, we have a management wing, you know, whatever you guys want, we'll do that with you. And at the point we had management, we didn't have anything else, and in the end we did a publishing deal with them, and that was the first thing.
Actually, before that even, they released the first, just in the UK, and
single
we did like a 500 pressings of a vinyl that they did for us, of our first ever single. And sort of, that was just like the first thing that really got us out there. They really hooked us up, and then things
and then
have sort
we did
of grown
a publishing deal that was just enough to quit our jobs, and then we were like, if by Christmas we need to try and do an album deal, we run out of money again. So we did that, but that was the first, you know, that was the thing that allowed us to go full time, which to me was always the biggest hurdle. That step between part time band and full time band is the biggest hurdle in any musician's career.
Difficult to jump. Yeah.
So while we're on the business side of things, of course, the way it's all written up, there was a major label bidding war.
I kind of had an argument actually about it for a while, because obviously there was some indies were pushing to try and sign us, and obviously the majors were sort of, you know, once one of them's interested, the rest of them all seem to sort of suddenly become interested, and they all want a piece. And we had this bit of an argument. Matt, our guitarist, is kind of, he's a bit of an indie kid. He was like, oh, we've got to go with an indie, you know, the majors will screw us over, whatever. But at the end of the day, we were like, but me and Johnny were like, oh, but, you know, look at all the amazing artists that RCA have had over the years. You know, it'd be so cool to be in that roster of all those incredible people. But at the end of the day, it came down to just the people. Like, we met all of the different teams from all these labels, and we just, like, clicked with the UK RCA team initially. And they were just such cool guys, and like,
the deals are the same now. The deals we had from the independent labels were the same as the offers we had from the majors.
Isn't that interesting how that all works in this digital world?
Yeah. If anything, on the money side, I think some of the independents offered us more. But and we just thought, well, how do you make this decision? And in the end, we thought, well, you have to sit in a room with these people every day and talk to them about your career and whatever it might be. And we sat in the room with so many labels where you'd have a bit of a cringe and be like, that's really kind of, you hear the cliches coming out and you just think, oh, you know, I'm not entirely comfortable. I sort of think, if this person is representing my band, you know, how do I feel about that? Would we come across well? And just the team at RCA that we met, you know, we just instantly sat down with them, we got on with them. It was a very enthusiastic team. They were kind of just very, they didn't seem to be any pretense. Yeah. And at the end, I thought, if we're considering going for an independent label just because we want to be on an indie and not a major, that is as much a kind of ridiculous bias as doing it the other way around. Yeah. And say, you know, like, there's no point in you know, making decisions just based on something so
arbitrary
and ridiculous or whatever it would be. Yeah. So all we thought was, like, we want to be in a place with people that we look forward to meeting every time we have to meet them.
Plus, I thought there might be a chance I'd get a free Sony PlayStation.
This Peter Kaitis. I've heard a lot of music of his, and obviously there must have been some interesting thought. And I'm very interested always in two things. Number one, how you got to him. And number two, how much of it was him and how much of it was you. Because the artist-producer relationship, and I've had the pleasure of being in that role a couple of times too, it's always interesting to hear how it got to where it got to.
Yeah, our producers, we worked with a few before we actually ended up with Peter, and we've had the kind of really invasive producers who will be like, oh, right, this song has to get down to 3 minutes, it's going to be the single, we need to chop that verse out, you know, cut this up. But he was way more laid back. He kind of said, didn't he? We said something like,
he was like, you know, you guys have done your album deal because you have songs that people like, and you know, whatever, for whatever reason, you can write songs, and it's not my job to come in and rewrite all your songs. So his role was much more, he kind of said, if you want advice on arrangements and stuff, I'll help you out, but that's not really what I do. And his thing was, he's basically an engineer, like a mix engineer. He has this incredible ear, and he would sit there, we'd be working, he'd say, guys, if you're playing your cymbals so hard, all of this spectrum of, you know, this frequency spectrum up here is just going to be full of cymbal wash, and I can't do anything with that. That's filling up so much space on your record. If you rein it in a bit, or if you don't have 10 guitars here, we've got all this space here in around this frequency range, and we can bring in some vintage synths here, and we can have some brass players in here, and we can do whatever. And he was like, let's try and make this, like, as interesting to the ear as possible.
Yeah. He wanted to fill, like, the whole sound spectrum with different instruments, rather than just have, you know, one really loud guitar that blasts through over everything. So his role was really like,
he was a bit of a
wizard sort of behind the desk, and he'd sort of always be suggesting, like, oh yeah, let's, I've got this crazy instrument that's exactly in that range that will just, you know, we can play a little line, come up with a line there. And so Matt would often be the one who'd, like, go in and just fiddle around on a keyboard or whatever, you know, Celeste,
the
all these
is,
crazy
I would
instruments.
Say, that noise is horrible, man. That noise has no place on this record. And he'd go, wait, and then he'd bed it somewhere down in the mix, and you'd think, something just happened there, and you can't even really tell it's there. But it's, and when we came to, he mixed the record as well. I mean, I think he works in that way. It's, his mixing is so integral to the making of the record. We could never have had anyone else to mix it for that reason. And when we took it to mastering, Tony Cousins mastered it at Metropolis, who's done a lot of like real, like huge records. And he said, you know, I don't need to do anything to this EQ-wise. He said, I've never really worked with a record like this. All I need to do is turn it up. He said, it's just, you know, it's just amazing. It's amazing he doesn't have mastering screens in front of him because his ear is incredible. And he's, I think, that really just spoke, you know, I mean, we loved the sound of the record anyway, but it was kind of really just kind of, I guess,
that was like the proof in the pudding, the basically, yeah, the pudding, the fact that, you know, he just nailed it.
And he's just a genuine audiophile, and he just has this crazy kind of ear for, yeah, so it was much more the engineering side that Caius brought to the record.
But yeah, the funny thing is, we didn't even really know that when we first decided we were going to go with him. We had no idea. We hadn't met him. Obviously, he was over here and we were in the UK. And we kind of heard loads of these records that he'd done, the National and Interpol, and thought they all sounded really cool. And, you know, The Boxer was one of our great record that we all loved. And we literally sent him an email. Someone told us, oh, you know, he doesn't really like to be contacted by labels. He's like a band guy. He wants to hear from us. So we sent him an email directly from us, just saying, hey, man, what's up? We're Dry the River, a London band. You know, it's some of our songs. We'd love to record with you. He was like, yeah, I'm up for this. Let's try and get it booked in.
It was the most organic thing. The label never directed. They said, who do you think of some producer you might like to work with? And we went through our record collection and said, we don't want to make a really hi-fi kind of, we've worked with a lot of people, these kind of very young producers who have Pro Tools and just everything's digital.
But it must be intriguing to have to now bring this out live. And also the fact that this is all very new and you're playing this to people who have heard Buzz and are listening to it for the first time live, might not have even heard this or might have heard one track. So what's that like?
It's awesome. Yeah, it's really cool. Like, just to get the exposing to more people and stuff. And, you know, for us, we've been touring in the UK and Europe a lot in the last 2 years. We've played everywhere. And I'm kind of one of those, I don't know what the term would be, but I grew up like loving American food, loving American like TV and movies.
Also worth saying,
like,
in America.
Yeah, I did. I grew up some of my youth in 4 or 5 years when I was really young in Florida. So I've always kind of felt like it's like my home away from home over here. I just absolutely love it. So getting like to tour over here is like the dream for us. And we, you know, this is what we're about to embark on after South By. We're doing this whole U.S. tour.
I think we like having a myth to dispel as well. Like, you know, I love to play to people who don't like our music because you have something to prove. It's great to play. I mean, we've just started to get to the level in the UK where we maybe do 1,000, play to 1,000 people in London or something, you know, and that's great because you come out, but you come out and they're singing the songs, and but you've already won by the time you walk on the stage. Yeah. Nobody, you know, it's great,
there's
but
no
it's so different
win.
Because you could play more or less terribly and people would sing all the words for you and it wouldn't, you know, whatever. Whereas if you play to a crowd who've never heard you, you really go out there feeling like you've got a battle to fight, and it really kind of like we've got to win people over.
Yeah.
And you see people's expressions, and whether they like it or don't like it, it's kind of like at least they, you know, showing them something new, and you're saying, you know, this is what our band's about. And we get really excited by that. I think it's, you know, so to be out in the US, and if there's a little bit of expectation as well, you have to work that a little bit harder. We like to be pushed kind of.
Well, there's that thing as well, like with the record, on record, we, you know, for the album and stuff and for the EP, we tried to sort of, obviously we've tried to capture the live sound a little bit, but it's much more like refined and stuff on the record. It's much more refined and sort of calm, whereas when we play live, I think our kind of rock roots come through a lot more. So hopefully we're kind of like surprise people a little bit if they have heard any of the songs, because the live show, you know, we do throw our hair around and jump around the stage a little bit, and you might not expect that when you listen to things like Weights and Measures on the Stage.
I've witnessed that and it's true. So the last thing we do is we do a thing called a musical sandwich, and I've done this with hundreds of bands. So it's two of your songs as the bread, and songs by any other artists you want to play in between,